I wanna say how much I love those two pops. That's what I want to say. Are you familiar with the Simone de quote? Yes. Attention is the purest form of generosity. Maybe you've heard this. That was in my, the one thing I know about Simone de, like the one thing I know about Wittgenstein. That's now nothing else to say.
Simple question I'm gonna just throw in there for Matthew. What is the unfashionable thing about your talk? I just took a peek at the title. And I know so you might have dropped the title off.
No, that's easy. I don't think genre is a fashionable idea right now. I think it seems conservative and obviously this incredible, such interesting work is being done across genres, and that's obvious. It's some of the most interesting writing that I'm interested in. But the mental discipline of, if genre is really about purpose and functionality, I think that we have an instinctive understanding of that for almost every other speech act. When it comes to poetry, it seems that almost none of us can say what it's for. And so it was an interesting mental discipline to apply that unfashionable concept of genre to poetry. You know, like as a kind of way of trying to think about, can that be addressed in that way? Of course it's limited and a failure ultimately and everything, but it is.
And just as a detail, that is it unfashionable to call something generic or unfashionable to write with the intention of being generic? Because those seem to be two different things.
When I say genre, by the way, I don't mean something like genre fiction, or I'm not referring to like detective fiction, or I mean what I mean is that generic divisions of things, that like kind of these sacred divisions of things into fiction and nonfiction, or whatever, you know, epic and all that. People don't. I think if you talk that way, you sound like a little fuddy-duddy. And so I guess that's why I didn't think that would seem. It felt unfashionable to me to talk about genre in that way, but maybe it secretly is fashionable. I'm unfashionable.
Well, it does seem like that's, and this again, goes back, 100 years, the idea of abolishing the divisions between prose poetry, as a very, very early example. And I think it's worth thinking both about, what's behind that impulse, like what possibilities are achieved by it, and then, at the same time, it's something that's always being kind of enacted, which means there must be something pushing against it as well, right? So, I do think that, and part of it, right, genre is always going to be defined in part, I think, by history, right? But, what's a genre? Well, it's this certain set of materials and the possibilities that arise out of them. And it seems like, the desire to abolish genre, there are a lot of, I think, good reasons behind that, but I think there's also a kind of push to abolish history at the same time, right? To try to get it in, and that's always something that, and it'd be nice to me to do it, but maybe not, maybe at the same time, not, right? I you awaken from that memory.
Other questions?
This is toward Matthew, but I think it applies to everything. And I was thinking about recently, I've been thinking a lot about this idea of nothingness and spaces, and poetry, meaning having so much to do with absence, or so on and so forth. And when you're talking about the idea of silence being that which surrounds a title or the words in a poem, what I was thinking was then what really comes to the foreground isn't nothing but the material, the page, or that which, quote, nothing travels through. Maybe similar to saying, like, in music, silence travels through the air like a note does. So I wonder what I'm really asking. Is it even worth distinguishing between nothing and something? Seriously.
That that's the, if you study Buddhism, that's the nihilistic fallacy. What you just said, not saying to be a dick, but like that's the thing that you get, that you have to work through that question you just asked.
That's you.
Oh.
That's a good move, Eric.
Yes, I think it is worship. Okay. But
I think so.
I was thinking about Lisa's, what she said. I was thinking about not. So you mentioned the page and the silence on the page. I think that's just a metaphor, that silence on the page. It's really, you know, Lisa, you were talking, you spoke so beautifully about this. Those sentences that you read to me, the way I understood that process was kind of pushing away a certain habitual way we engage with perception or language or pulling things through. And then once you push it away, what are you left with? So it's a kind of creating space by a forceful, that's more what I mean, like by your kind of refusal to do whatever it is that you usually do with language, and then what starts to happen. You know, but that can happen on the very, like on the word level, or it can happen more on the kind of like conceptual level, I guess. So that's sort of how, does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, you described that in a way that feels very much in tune with how I was thinking of it, and whether that speaks to your question is open question for you. But the terms bring to mind, so what's the end of the snowman? And the listener who listens in snow.
Nothing that is,
and then there's Auden's, you know, poetry makes something happen. It survives in the valley of its saying, of its own making. Yes, exactly. And I'm interested in how the word nothing, and I think it could probably happen the same, similarly with the word something, when the syntax allows it to function as a verb, you know, something that is nothing itself, able to undo itself for what something else to happen, perhaps, or for it to become something else, or nothing else, maybe, but unto nothing that. Poetry makes nothing happen as an action, as an activity, perhaps, if you read the syntax that way in Auden's statement. So I think that it's a provocative and lively and potentially enlivening question to ask if it is, you know, worth thinking about the difference between something and nothing, because it brings attention to the words and the different ways in which they can act in relation to each other and on other things and with other words and ideas.
Actually, you reminded me that I had a little cluster of questions. Just about the sentence practice, and to what degree the sentence's idea is, are you thinking of it as a kind of minimal form in which to contain or enact these perceptions? Because it seems to me like, you know, it becomes as much a study of the sentence as it is a study of whatever it is that you were putting into the sentence.
We do find that to be the case, and I am a person, not a person who worked very naturally in the unit of sentence, of meaning being the sentence in my poems. They are more fragmented, I suppose, although units of sense, but, and so they probably would laugh, and in fact my whole, it first happened because I asked an MFA workshop, the entire class, we did this for the entire semester, and it was 10 a day. It was 10 a day for 5 days. I think it takes 2 days off. It was a total immersion, and it was amazing. But they would laugh at the idea of it being minimalist, because I wanted what it seemed that the challenge was to have these sentences be not minimalist at all, if this is, speaks to that, but really, really capacious and long and endless and piling of detail on top of detail. And that requires, of course, the handling of the sentence, very carefully, with the conventions of grammar and punctuation and syntax. And so it was both, for sure. And we never recovered. But yeah, there are three of us who never stopped doing it, and there are others in that group who still say that they do it on their own. It was so whatever it was that I've never brought it again to the classroom. I wanted, it's Valerie who talks about something happening so magnificently just once that it can never happen again. I haven't wanted to do it with class since then.
There's a question. I have a sort of a half thought question, which is all of you, what your paper seemed to have in common was that to some extent the poetry of the poetry was not easily or quickly graspable in the flicker, or it was in the shiver, or it was in the voice, or the nothing of the something. And we've gone through, in the last several decades, and we're still going through, an incredible sort of social argument and complexity of terms with very different poetries emerging, such as identity-based poetries, conceptual poetry that has been much maligned. And I was struck, I definitely heard in John Beer's paper an interesting twerking of those values of poetry that I don't know that could be even thought as Adorno-esque into a kind of race subcurrent issues because of Overson's work they put into a poem. But again, a poem that was not exactly hitting over the head with racial issues or even deliberately explicit. So my question is, how do you, in talking about poetry, you just had to talk about poetry, so in some way I'm pushing into poetics, how do you deal with indeed a kind of almost metaphysical or abstract set of issues in relation to the culture, social rawness, maybe its intensity, etc.
Like in my list of my own examples, working in the orchard, or being in a play, or writing music, or writing lyrics for a musician, many of my students on their list of such examples would be committing to political activism. And obviously that requires extreme attentiveness to what is going on and to the language of the discourse. And I really think that the sort of interrelationality that I'm talking about, that is, it must include the energy going in that direction as well. And if it's whatever one is giving one's attention to, then that is part of it. Or, if that's what we're doing, that's what you're doing. That's what then poetry is. It's informed by.
Yeah, that seems really right to me. And I guess maybe I would add that, think Roberson's style of thinking about poetry comes, in part through the kind of projectivism that Baraka himself grew up in and helped to shape. And the idea that something, things like the structures of race and class in America that continue to bedevil us, and the diseases of the imagination, and that I think that, that's certainly more direct forms of engagement and activism are valuable, but that there is also a place for a kind of, I think like deep tissue recalibration, and that I think of Nathaniel Mackey or Ed Roberson, Cecil Jiskin was all engaging in that form of work.
Boy howdy, I got a lot of thoughts about this. But just two things, three really. First of all, we're in a super fucked up time, obviously, and it's hard to be, and I think for all of us it's a kind of wound in a way to being poets, like want to be useful, at least the poets I know do, and I think that's a good, I think that comes from the right place. But my conflicting thought to that is I didn't get into this business to be told what to do either. And if I want to write about flowers all day long and then go be a good citizen, I think that's okay too. But in getting into the more kind of like trying more directly answer your question the simplest way I can, I think that's a secret subject actually. The book that I just wrote is What Is All This For? And I think that I agree with what Stephen says in his essay / talk, The Noble Writer and the Sound of Words, when he says, the role of the poet is to help us live our lives. And I think that if you are, I really want to agree with what my two patrons said about, I think if you're a person who cares deeply about politics and the environment, and that's a part of your imagination, that those things will come out in your poems. But you need to, I do also believe that we can't forget what we're doing when we make poems. And what we're doing, I think, is a kind of refusal to be useful in a certain way. I think that is, I know that is not a popular idea among many people, but I think it is part of what we do with language, is we refuse to make it useful in a way it's useful on all the other parts of our lives, and we free ourselves. It's a liberation, it's a liberty. And the consequences of that liberty may be that you end up writing about flowers, or maybe that you end up writing about race. I mean, either all the other problems you said to the devil last night. But I think you have to be led there by your true, genuine concerns. And I see a lot of poems going wrong, but people feel obligated to write about those things, but secretly they'd rather be lying in the grass, like snuffling in the dirt, like writing about what that feels like, which is okay too.
Other questions? We have time for one or two more questions.
So I initially come from a cultural anthropology background, and I was thinking about the shift to post-colonial cultural anthropology when you're talking about sentence construction and objective observation, because the whole reason why post-colonial cultural anthropology came about was because when the anthropologists that came before them tried to remove themselves from the anthropology, it made implicit a lot of racism and biases and normalization, and your objective sentence construction and observation exercise kind of moved in the opposite direction. And I was just wondering if there was any concern ever that you would find that things were made implicit that should not have been.
Oh, I mean, we talked about that. We talk about it a lot. And it, because of the work that has been done and all the thinking and the theorizing that has been done about observation and about objectivity, we are completely working within that, you know, frame. And at the same time trying to see what you're seeing, but not without awareness, absolutely, of, you know, the illusory notion of, you know, this being impossible, and yet there are things, and you look at them, and then to say what that is, right? But you can't, you, to do it without being aware of this troubled dynamic would be blithe. So thank you for bringing that up.
This is more of a quick comment than a question. I just wanted to go back to this idea about writing about flowers or writing about other things. And I think there's a kind of a privilege implied in the fact that there's a choice in whether you write about flowers or write about race or other issues. And I think for some people, it might feel like it's not a choice that they have. And I was thinking about it because I just, in Portland, heard a poet reading named Kathy Jethill Kitchener, who is a poet who studied at the University of Hawaii and then at Mills College. So she came up in an environment that's very similar to a lot of us, but she's a Marshall Islander, and her islands are inundated by sea level rise. And so she wrote a poem about that and did a YouTube video related to it, and it was picked up by people who are in the climate movement. And they asked her to be a poem at the UN Climate Summit a couple of years ago, and she got a lot of fame and attention for that, and she became known as a climate change poet, she said. And she thought, well, I write about a lot of other things. That's not my only identity. But then she said, but I'm going to embrace this identity, and I will write as many poems about climate change as I need to write until the situation of Marshall Islanders becomes known around the world. So she's really taken that topic on. And one of the negotiating terms of the last climate summit was 2 degrees warming is where we need to cap it. And that means the Marshall Islands will be inundated. So she wrote a poem called 1.5, because that's the temperature rise where maybe the Marshall Islands will survive and her people won't have to leave their islands. The agreement came out at 1.5. Now, I have no idea how much her poem played a part in that decision. It was very widely noted by delegates. But I just wanted to point out that, you know, there is a sense maybe that not everybody feels they have that choice.
Well, actually, first of all, I mean, oh boy. Yeah, that wasn't exactly what I was saying, but I mean, I think you're right. I think I can see where you're coming from, but I guess I'd like to imagine a world where people would have that choice, and I've seen the opposite. What's so interesting about your comment is that she felt, in a way, kind of, I mean, I guess I was limited as an artist by other people's perception of her. And so maybe this is wrong, but what I want to do is brush in and tell her, no, don't just only write this poem about climate change. It's okay if you don't want to only do that. You know, that's not all you have to do. And because, I mean, I've seen people who have a certain identity or come from a certain place who feel, I think, imprisoned in having to only write from that space, and that makes me so feel sorrowful for them. You know, so I want to defend the right to do the other things too. Also, not instead of, but also. I mean, we can write a lot of that. That's just the way I see it. Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay, we only have time for one or two more questions, and I did see a hand here before, and I also see Aaron, so I'm going to choose these two.
It's a very brief comment. I'll stick with what I was going to say earlier, although this conversation is extremely interesting. That's just come up. I was going to say a quote to add to what you said about poetry not being useful, or poetry attempting to be not useful, which is an Anwar Bezi Philip quote I heard earlier this year. The value of the poet is to make consumption difficult. Feels related also to the point about being a climate change poet.
Yes, and a brief remark. I just feel that that suggests an impoverishment of the flower. And I say that because I'm going to be talking about the sky on the panel on poetics tomorrow. So we'll be discussing that tomorrow.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. You know, that I mean, ideally, you know, any point is an entry point to everything, right? That to me is the deepest, you know, one of the deepest lessons of poetry. So, yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna let us go to about 4:45, so this panel has its full time. There were a few questions. I'll try to stand over here.
I would just like to note that what we're all discussing here is around freedom, right? We're all discussing our personal freedom. So how far does freedom go in developing the poetics through a particular writer? How far does the poetics go in the freedom? Or how does the freedom limit or expand the poetics?
There's a lot It's okay. I guess, you know, maybe to run with the kind of guidance of what I was saying. I mean, I think, you know, language in as much as it's shared, and it's the medium, or it's a medium within which we encounter one another and encounter the world, there is inherently a political dimension to it. That may not be the only dimension to it, right? And I think that, but the possibility of articulating, again, both political actualities and diagnosing them, and then imagining more capacious possibilities. I think that certainly Ed Roberson for me is a model of how that can work. And then, you know, not often implicitly, right? It's often not explicit.
There were more questions than there were behind and keep like the beginning of what is a novel. So